Hey, I'm Josh Barrow, your new host of Left, Right, and Center. Every week, join Rich Lowry, Bob Scheer, and me for a contentious yet civilized debate of the week's big political stories, from ISIS to the U.S. economy to this 47-candidate presidential election we're having. You can find Left, Right, and Center on KCRW's iTunes page.
Everything around you becomes numb sometimes. You just, you numb up. You try to, you know, close your feelings off where you don't try to feel nothing. You feel like there's no hope. It's not to the point where you want to commit suicide. But sometimes I feel at the point that we want to write the judge and say, just give me the death penalty. Just give me the death penalty, man.
Paul Rhett had spent 14 years in solitary confinement at Pelican Bay. He's part of a settlement that will bring big changes to how California prisons use solitary confinement. The settlement between prisoners and the state announced today affects thousands of prisoners who will be moved out of solitary cells. Some have been in what's called the SHU for up to 20 years. Carol Strickman is a staff attorney at Legal Services for Prisoners with Children. She was one of the lawyers for the prisoners who filed the lawsuit that led to today's settlement. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Well, let's begin with the concerns by the union representing California corrections officers. They declined to join us today, but they're still they have some concerns. They're still reviewing the settlement, and they've said that this will take prisoners back to how it was many decades ago, 40 years ago, when inmates killed each other and guards at much higher rates, and that prisons in general will be much more dangerous places now. What do you say to that?
I think it's completely wrong. In our case, one of the things we did was we hired security experts who looked at the statistics and looked at other prison systems, and they said that the current program of locking people up indefinitely for membership in a gang with no behavior was not conducive to public, you know, to safety in the prisons. And there's no proof that it's doing anything towards reducing prison violence. And the converse is that there's no reason that releasing large numbers of people will affect prison safety. Also, you know, kind of quietly in the last 2 years, the Department of Corrections has been implementing its own reform program, a program that we say didn't go far enough, but they were evaluating and moved out of a Pelican Bay SHU and other SHUs hundreds, more than 500 prisoners to a general population. And they report that there has not been any significant problems with that. So the track record isn't what the union fears.
So SHU stands for Security Housing Units, and there are, I believe, some 2,800 people in the SHU right now.
I think there's 3,000, actually.
Uh-huh.
And there's 4 male SHUs and 1 woman's.
Uh-huh.
And I looked it up as of, June. That's the statistics are on the department website, and
okay,
I came up with 3,000. But anyway, that's roughly right.
So roughly 3,000. And so how many of them will be moved out of the SHU?
Well, you know, that's a good question. We don't have those statistics. The CDCR has them. That would be a good question to ask them. I can say that in our class of people from Pelican Bay, as of June, there were about 850 that at that time. But this settlement includes people in the other SHUs, so I don't have access to that data. I've heard, 1,600 maybe would be reviewed, but I don't know how solid that number is. And of those, we think the majority will be moved out of the SHU, but I don't know. You know exactly how mm-hmm. many, the vast mm-hmm. majority. The criteria is going to be, did this person commit a serious rules violation, that was found guilty of a serious rules violation that would make them eligible to be in the SHU or in solitary in the last 2 years? And if they did not, then the presumption is they would be removed to a high level general population unit, minus a few small exceptions.
Right. And so that was the initial issue, right, on the part of the plaintiffs, that people were being assigned to the SHU not for behavioral violations per se, but if they were deemed to be affiliated with a gang in some way. And that could include something as seemingly small as writing a piece of poetry that was seen as gang affiliated, or having a prison tattoo, a gang prison tattoo.
That's exactly right. It was status-based. Not behavior-based. And even then, the status finding was questionable. And, as you say, artwork is one of the ones that bugs us. Artworks, writings that are in someone's cell. Signing a greeting, a birthday card, if it has a certain emblem on it, like a shamrock, that, those kind of things would keep you in another 6 years if you had one of those things. And so it was really a fairly absurd situation, except it was, causing grievous harm to people.
Right. And so that was part of your lawsuit, that there have been some serious physical and psychological consequences. Can you describe what those are?
Well, yes. We had mental health experts who interviewed large numbers of people in the SHU at Pelican Bay. And, there's the problems of, hopelessness. You heard Paul Redd, who was just, you've quoted there. Mm-hmm. But, total hopelessness, depression, anxiety, inability to sleep, some paranoid feelings, sometimes anger that they don't want to express, so they hold back, and then it just causes, we saw high blood pressure and, just a lot of emotional problems that can develop, and they carry on not only while you're there, but it doesn't go away once you're released to general population or to the community. There was Terry Cooper's a psychiatrist who interviewed five people who were in the community and others who were in general population after a long SHU stint, found a persistent mental harm.
And so part of the settlement will also be to limit the amount of time people spend in the SHU. So they won't be there indefinitely anymore.
Yes. The reason for that is the way that comes about is you won't go into the SHU indefinitely, which is what it has been, for association, for membership. You will only go in if you have been found guilty in a hearing of a SHU-eligible offense. The maximum term for that is 5 years. And so, and you can earn some good time credit off of that, good conduct credit, whatever, off of that 5 years, depending on how you behave while you're in the SHU. So, at least no one's going to go in. That's why we've virtually eliminated it. I suppose someone could have multiple stacked individual findings, but at Pelican Bay, no one will be there for more than 5 years, although they could be transferred to other SHUs. The Pelican Bay was the prison that we thought was the harshest, mm-hmm. In terms of conditions, and so there's a 5-year cap there. So in those ways, we're radically reducing or eliminating the legal framework that allowed the department to put someone in indefinite SHU, long-term SHU.
This class action lawsuit was filed in 2012 after prisoners at Pelican Bay engaged in hunger strikes. And California had the most amount of prisoners in solitary and in the harshest conditions, spending up to 23, 24 hours a day in solitary. Are you surprised that this settlement came about relatively quickly in legal terms? I guess it came about relatively quickly in just 3 years.
Well, it doesn't seem that quick to me, but because we've been all working so very hard over this time.
I mean, these cases sometimes can go on for decades, you know?
Yes, they can, and that's the advantage of a settlement for both sides, that you you reach a resolution. And what I think caused it, what was to happen, a combination of we've seen through the hunger strikes and the community support and the education that's been going on, a growing sense in this country that that solitary confinement's a problem. It's getting out of hand. We shouldn't do it. It's inhumane. You know, the UN has weighed in. You know, so we saw President Obama this year and a justice of the U.S. Supreme Court make statements against it. So public opinion has changed, and that creates a better environment to reach resolution. Secondly, we had, as I mentioned, expert reports. We had 10 really great experts who filed written reports back in March. And I think that was so strong relative to the few reports that the other side had, that it was clear that we had the facts and the law on our side.
All right. And we have to move on, but thank you very much for joining us today.
Okay, thank you. Okay.
Carol Sterkman, staff attorney at Legal Services for Prisoners with Children. Now let's take a more personal look at the effects of solitary confinement. We just heard Carol talk about the psychological and physical impacts isolation can have. Now someone who has experienced it, Anthony Graves, spent nearly 2 decades on death row in Texas for murders he did not commit. He was released 5 years ago, but while in prison, he spent much of his time in solitary confinement, and he joins me now. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Well, how much time did you spend in solitary confinement?
I spent approximately 16 out of the 18 and a half years that I was incarcerated in solitary confinement.
16 years?
Yes, because that's the way we were housed.
And was that because of the crimes you were convicted of?
Yeah, I was on death row, and death row is housed in solitary confinement. Everyone is in solitary confinement.
I see. So describe the conditions. What was it like being in an isolation unit?
Well, I mean, it's more mental than physical. I mean, the physical part is, you can deal with that. It's the mental part. It's the depression. It's the hopelessness. It's the loneliness. It's just schizophrenia. It's watching guys self-inflict themselves. It's going out of your mind. It's not knowing, what the next day is going to be like, if you're going to ever get out of this place or not. It's mental. It's mental that breaks you down emotionally, spiritually. The physical, yeah, it's bad. I mean, you're confined to a 60 square feet of space 23 hours a day. No TV, no radios, unless you can afford a radio sometime. But if you're on a level, like a level 2 or level 3, you don't even get a radio, but you're still in solitary confinement. You come out your cell, you get a shower 3 times a week. The 1 hour that you do come out, you come out by yourself and you just put in a bigger cage. Where you're housed in 60 feet, your rec area is maybe 120 feet. And you're just in that space by yourself for 1 hour, then you come back and you go back into your cell. And it's a desolate place.
Yeah, it sounds awful, awful, and unimaginable. How did you, for 16 years, I mean, did you lose your mind? Did you go crazy?
No, I never lost my mind, and I always like to say, because naivete saved my life. I just thought, you know, being innocent, at some point this would be over with and I can go home. Now, that's just me. I call myself the exception and not the rule, because when I was there, I watched men and witnessed men hanging themselves, witnessed men slitting their throats, witnessed men overdosing on their medication, witnessed men dropping their pills just so they can be executed. I mean, you know, it was a place that was literally driving men out of their minds. I witnessed that, and, you know, at sometime at night I'll lay down and I think about my own mortality, you know, because every day for 6,640 days, I witnessed some sort of inhumanity going on behind those bars.
So how did you keep your mind together, aside from believing in your innocence and hoping that you would get out soon? What did you do every day to just keep it together?
Well, one of the things I tried to do is not live behind those bars. And when I say that is that I read a lot. I wrote a lot of letters. I had a lot of international support. So I would, for example, I would write someone who was like over in France. I'd never been to France. And I would ask them, I'd say, well, you know, when you get up Saturday morning. I want you to spend the day with me, and meaning that I want you to go out and let me see everything you see through your eyes so that I can live outside of these bars, because I can't live back here. It's just too inhumane. So I need some eyes on the outside that will allow me to live out there with them. So they will go and take pictures of their city that day, and they'll number them, and they'll tell me where they was, and they'll send me pictures so that I can actually live in France, you know, in my mind, instead of having to live back there. So it's a little mind game. You have to also understand that that the situation that you're in is not normal, but that there are outlets. You know, people, it's important for people to write to people and let them know that they cared about, and giving them that outlet to release, because just sitting back there with no one in your life literally just makes you want to give up. So my thing was to always keep people in my life, read, and just try to stay focused on something positive.
Now, you are a rare case because you are innocent and on death row.
Not that rare. 154 of us have been exonerated.
Right. But you must have seen other prisoners who were truly dangerous and violent.
Of course. I mean, you have guys, for example, someone down there that's mentally ill, and you got him in that type of situation, turns him into a very dangerous person, not only to others, but to himself as well. As I said, I used to watch guys would take razors and just cut on their bodies. They're going out of their mind. So if they'll cut on themselves, you know darn well they'll cut on you. But this is because of the condition.
So you think that actually putting them in solitary makes them more violent?
Of course.
It makes the prison more violent.
I was listening to the statement from the Union for the Officers talking about how this would set back prisons because of the danger. And I'm saying to myself, that is only a union statement from someone who's probably never been to prison, because solitary confinement is dangerous in itself. It drives men to attempt suicide. It makes you feel hopeless and helpless. It makes you feel lonely. You go through bouts of depression, schizophrenia. That is more dangerous than putting someone out there and counseling them up and putting them in a group setting to where and make it a setting that's a rehabilitative setting, not a setting of all this baggage that you put on guys. You got so many rules that if they walk wrong, that they go to the chute. If they talk wrong, that they go to the chute. If they have a hot pot out of place, they go to the chute. If they got too many letters in their cell, they go to a chute. So you keep this type of tension going on, you know, and then you say the inmates can't function because they don't want to get on. No, look at the environment you create. You create this environment so that you can tell the public that these men are dangerous. But if you create an environment that you're actually trying to help these men become better men so that when they re-enter society, that they actually come with some tools to succeed instead of putting all this baggage on them so that when they come out here, they have a hard time and they end up going back. The problem is, it's the environment that the system creates that could continue to create tension among everyone, because just the rules itself creates tension. And then you say they can't get along. Well, look at the environment you created. Mm-hmm. Okay, let's look at the environment first. So
what do you think of the California announcement that they're going to take a lot of people
I think it's a great thing. Now, this is what I would say, that I think it should be a gradual process, because these guys have been back there for many, many years. This is going to be a culture shock to them. So it's a gradual process. You want to assess where everyone to understand the state of mind at the time that you're going to be releasing them back out to the general population. Because some men have lost their mind. Some men have lost hope. Some men don't care no more. You need to know those things before you just put people back in society. But that's it. That's a program that you should create to help work these men back into society. Don't just turn them loose and then they go out there and they can't deal and you say, oh, they're all bad men. We need to lock them up again. You set them up.
Right.
You set them up. No reentry. You need a reentry program if you're going to really be successful at this transition. A reentry program into population will work for these guys instead of just turning them all loose.
All right. Well, I want to thank you so much for sharing your story with us today.
Thank you.
That's Anthony Graves. He spent 18 years on death row in Texas. And we want to know what you think about the changes California is making to solitary confinement. Will it help with rehabilitation? Will it make prison more dangerous? Was it about time? Leave us a voicemail, 1-844-PRESS-PLAY, or you can comment on our Facebook page, KCRW Press Play. Coming up, a doctor is on trial for murdering her patients. They overdosed on painkillers she prescribed them. We'll have that story next on Press Play.
Are you thinking about buying a new car? Consider donating your old one to KCRW and support the unique mix of news, music, and culture you love. You'll become a KCRW member and get a nice tax write-off. For details, visit kcrw.com/cars.
You're listening to Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Over a three-year period from 2007 to 2010, Dr. Lisa Tseng wrote more than 27,000 drug prescriptions. That's about 25 a day. Some of the appointments at her storefront medical clinic in Roland Heights lasted as little as 3 minutes. Well, now she's on trial for second-degree murder in the cases of three young men, patients who overdosed on opioid painkillers she prescribed. One of the men, Joey Rivero, an Arizona State student, had driven 300 miles from Tempe, Arizona, to get painkillers from Dr. Tseng. In opening statements, prosecutors said she had been warned by law enforcement that her patients were overdosing, but Dr. Tseng's defense attorney said her client could not be held responsible when patients did not use the drugs as prescribed. Well, Professor Stephen Smith is here now. He teaches health law at California Western Law School. Welcome.
Thank you.
Well, first of all, how important is this case? You don't often hear of a doctor on trial for murder.
I think it is important for a number of reasons. There has been a real epidemic of abuse of painkillers and overprescription of painkillers, and there are a variety of federal and state laws to deal with it. They have been only partially successful, and there still remain extreme cases of overprescription. And a murder charge is kind of society's ultimate criminal weapon of saying that this is unacceptable. So it's important because it will affect prescribing privileges. Prescribing practices for many physicians, I suspect, over the next several years.
Well, are there any safeguards in place to prevent overprescribing?
There are a number of safeguards. I mean, there are a lot of federal laws regarding controlled substances, which are the particularly dangerous drugs and those that are subject to abuse. There are a lot of federal laws, and the federal government has been reasonably aggressive in going after overprescribers with felony convictions, not murder, but drug abuse and drug controlled substance limitation abuse that for several years. But nonetheless, since around the year 2000, the number of deaths from prescription drugs has increased.
Yeah, it has become, as they say in some places, an epidemic.
It really is. I mean, there are 44 people a day who in America who die of prescription overdose.
Wow. Well, what do you think of her defense? And that is that she's basically shouldn't be held responsible for what her patients do with her drugs. Maybe some of her patients had mixed the drugs with alcohol or another substance. And, you know, she wasn't there with them when they overdosed.
Yeah, I think that will be the substance of her defense, probably. And it is essentially in a legal sense. It is that she did not cause the deaths. I mean, there has to be a connection between someone's conduct and the death of someone for there to be a successful murder conviction. She is essentially claiming, look, I didn't cause this. There were too many other factors involved. I could not have caused this. And that will be, I suspect that will for the jury be the core issue, because there's a lot of data about what she did with her prescription. It's the outcome of these three deaths, as well as some others with which she's not charged, are relatively clear. So the question is then causation, and can she be held responsible since there were a lot of other factors, which you described as especially the one, which is the people who died, the victims, took these drugs inappropriately and went to her for the purpose of getting drugs inappropriately. I suspect the prosecution is going to claim that she had a special duty as a physician, as someone who has a special license to be able to prescribe these drugs, to know what she's doing, not to do so in a reckless fashion, and that the very fact that she prescribed these drugs recklessly was enough to assume a major responsibility for what happened.
Yeah. Well, so you alluded to this earlier that this will be will provide a chilling effect on physicians. Do you think that physicians are looking at this closely and will then modify their behavior en masse?
Well, I think that it will have some impact. And one of the difficult things for the law always and for law enforcement is to modify the behavior you want to modify without having unintended consequences. So in this case, the purpose is to reduce the number of bad prescriptions that are given without adequate interviews and without adequate checking of whether they may be abused, to put a damper on that, but at the same time not make it so difficult to prescribe or so scary for a physician to prescribe these drugs that they don't give them to the people who really need them, the people who are in great pain and really need them. And if the chilling effect goes too far, it can really be harmful.
Yeah. And so California has this database called Cures. It's supposed to alert doctors to patients who are, you know, shopping around for drugs.
Right. And it's just, even though it's Cures is the right name for it, it's the Controlled Substance Utilization Review and Evaluation System. Uh-huh. So there are extra words in there.
Okay. Well, is it working?
No, it's not. And the state has recognized that it's not working. It's making changes in it. It was passed 7 or 8 years ago, but it's a computer system in which the dispensers of the pharmacies and so on report people who have most control, who get prescriptions for most controlled substances 2, 3, and 4. And then physicians and others are able to query that bank to make sure that they are not giving drugs to people who have dangerous drugs, to people who have already gotten prescriptions filled for these same drugs. The trouble was it's sort of clunky, and it was hard to get permission to use the system for physicians. And in fact, only 10% of physicians who were prescribing these substances were eligible, ended up making application, becoming eligible to query the system. So it broke down there, and there were a lot of queries to it, but there were an awful lot of physicians not making inquiries. So the state's in the process, the Department of Justice in California is in the process of updating the system, what they call Cures 2.0, with the hope that it will allow physicians in good faith to make sure that they don't have patients who are abusing the drugs by getting multiple prescriptions from multiple doctors.
Stephen Smith teaches health law at California Western Law School. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And what do you think? What is the doctor's responsibility to make sure his or her patients do not abuse prescription drugs? Give us your feedback at 1-844-PRESSPLAY or on Facebook or Twitter at KCRW Press Play. Coming up, the extension of the 710 freeway into the Pasadena area has been a controversial subject for a long, long time.
Since the mid-1950s, it has been studied. These original studies led to a route adoption in 1964.
But it's finally been decided that there will be no extension, at least above ground, and the houses that Caltrans bought using eminent domain to make way for it are about to go up for sale. We'll talk about what that means for the people living in those homes in a bit. But next, the creators of Comedy Central's Drunk History are here to explain their process. That's after a news update with Eric Roy.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel, stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage on our mobile app or online at kcrw.com.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. My next guests are the creators of the web series turned Funny or Die series turned Comedy Central series Drunk History, which returns tonight for its third season. Each episode features inebriated friends and guests of the show, from Tim Heidecker to Lisa Bonet, recounting events from American history. Here's the writer Dan Harmon introducing a segment from the new season.
Hey.
Hello.
Hello. I'm Dan Harmon, and today I'd like to tell you the story of Griselda Blanco, the godmother of cocaine.
The episodes are hosted by Derek Waters, who created the show, along with Jeremy Connor. Welcome, both of you.
Thank you so much. KCR dubs.
What, he was drunk then, right?
Dan?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Dan was very drunk, although you mentioned that Lisa Bonet and Tim Heidecker were drunk. They were just the reenactors in those episodes.
Right. So that's the thing, is you have the celebrities reenact
whatever the drunk narrator has said.
The drunk narrator. And the drunk narrator, they're not as well known, usually. Not as well known as Dan Harmon, for example.
Sometimes, yeah. We like to make it feel like there are people that you know. You know, they don't take you out of the story of like, oh my God, there's Arsenio Hall getting drunk, you know?
Right.
We've been trying to get him for years.
So you actually get them really, really drunk,
mm-hmm,
right?
Mm-hmm.
They get themselves really drunk.
Right. There's no force feeding, and no one's drinking for the first time. And it's not about, oh, let's see how drunk they can get. It's how can we get them to tell this very interesting story that is important in history and not make it boring. That really is the goal, more than like, look how they're on the ground. It's like, oh my God, I'm laughing at this person's like modern dialogue in this 1800s story, but I'm actually learning something too. Because all the stories are true.
Yeah. So do they come to you, or do you come to them with a story?
We started where they just came to us, but then over the years, and when we have a TV show,
you have to make episodes, you know. It can't just be like, oh, we're gonna each, because we battled with how is this not just a 5-minute idea, because to me it always was. And then we worked and figured out how can we be seeing 3 stories an episode. Let's figure out one thing that ties them together. And so we chose cities that each episode would take place in that city, and we'd be learning about that city's history.
But this year, we have a lot more themed episodes.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. So what's new in season 3?
Well, oh, man.
Our themed are spies. We're going to learn about spies. Mm-hmm. We've all heard about Harriet Tubman freeing the slaves, but we also, what she also did was work as a spy, which is pretty cool. And children's author, Roald Dahl. Remember that guy?
Yeah.
Pretty cool.
Charlie and the Chocolate Factory.
Yeah.
Yeah. He was a British spy.
He was?
Yeah. And Will Ferrell plays him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he spied on the Americans to make sure that we were good allies.
He was getting his information from sexual relations with important women.
Pillow talk.
Pillow talk. Yeah.
Which important women?
You got to find out on the show, because we don't remember their names.
Sounds like a mini episode of Drunk History right now. I know you're not drunk.
It's just this voice. Like, I'm sorry.
So you came up with these ideas, these themed ideas.
Yeah, just to limit ourselves, you know, make the world bigger, you know. So we have spies. We have a history of games, learning about Milton Bradley, how he started. Yeah, so themes, we have 8 cities and 5 themes this season. So it's great. And tonight we go to the little place called New Jersey. Maybe you've heard of it.
Yes.
Garden State, Bruce Springsteen, Bon Jovi.
Dripping with history. And so who's in it?
Greg Kinnear. Stephen Merchant returns as Abraham Lincoln. And we got Tony Hale. Mm-hmm. We got Christopher Maloney, Justin Long, Jason Ritter, Jenny Slate.
Jenny Slate's the narrator.
Our all-time favorite.
Oh, my God. So you got her drunk. Or she got herself drunk.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she did it season 1, and she was so good that we wanted to have her back.
Now, so what makes a narrator good?
Likeability. And knowing how to tell the beginning, middle, and end of a story, and not an alcoholic.
Do you rehearse them? Do you just say, here's the story, go?
We make sure that they like it. We usually send them about 3 to 4 stories that we're definitely doing that season.
And it's not scripted.
No, nothing is scripted. The only thing that we'll have them say is like a date or how to pronounce someone's name if they're not saying it right. But they pick the stories that we have to send them, and I always say, if you don't like any of them, don't say yes, because there's nothing worse than watching someone pretend to love something. They have to love it, and that's the goal, is they're telling a story they're very passionate about and they're excited to tell you about. And so when we get to their place, we shoot for about 4 to 6 hours of them telling me over and over and over and over again until we think we have it.
Is that enjoyable for you?
It is. I love people. Me, like, 2 years ago didn't love it as much as I do now, because I kind of know.
What changed?
I just know more of what I'm getting into. Like the first hour and a half, I just know isn't going to be usable. As in, I'm just trying to make them comfortable, having a drink with them. They're going to try to be funny, because what human being wouldn't do that with alcohol in them with a camera in front of them?
So you're kind of their drinking buddy, friend.
Yeah, yeah.
Who is the best get that you got?
Well, it's not me being cheesy or like sweet, but every get is really good, because they're agreeing to, let's be honest, it's a cable show. It doesn't pay a lot. It's 12 full hours of moving your lips to a drunk person. We shoot every story in one day, so we have to get everything done in one day. So every get is really good. But surprises that you're like, oh my God, like Octavia Spencer is going to play Harriet Tubman this
Academy
year.
Academy Award winner.
Oh, right. Sorry.
Octavia Spencer. I mean, it's crazy that she said
wanted
yes
to do it.
Yeah.
Sam Rockwell plays Bugsy Siegel this year with Dennis Quaid as Lucky Luciano, which I think is our best casting. We got That's really amazing. Great. Parker Posey plays this woman named Mary Phelps Jacob who invented the bra. And
oh, she's going to be great.
I love that part.
But does it all rises and falls on the narrator?
It's all about the story. If the story isn't good, why would you watch it? And then the storyteller, you know, it all starts there.
Has anything ever gone really wrong where you've had to?
Oh, yeah. Like, had to what?
Well, just not like stop filming and mm-hmm. not.
I think the scariest moment for me was when Nick Rutherford brought out swords.
Yeah.
He was like, he really wanted to go play with real swords. And we were like, okay, wait, time out. This is actually not.
And he was wasted.
Oh, yeah. He was extremely drunk.
Yeah, swords.
Has anyone gotten really too drunk?
Yeah, well, now we can talk about it, because she just talked about it in an interview. As Natasha Leggero did the Patty Hearst story season one and got blind drunk. And too drunk that she put on a bathing suit and wanted to shoot the rest in the bathtub that she had just filled with moisturizer, thinking she was putting in bubbles. So, and
yeah, she poured in like a half a bottle of this moisturizer, just filled the bathtub with this oily.
And which sounds so funny, right? That sounds funny.
Were you recording this whole time?
No, because there's a fine line between funny and sad. And when it's sad, it's not, I don't want to touch it, you know? And so we stayed with her until she was okay. We have a medic to make sure everyone's all right. And once she was at a good level, we left, and then we had to shoot it like a week later. But that's the only time for the show we've had to shoot stuff. But when we did it online and no one was paying us like $2, like that would happen all the time.
Yeah. So do you personally like to get drunk and tell stories?
I do. Yeah, no, and now I really do, because we know so much. This is exactly the kind of history that I've always enjoyed, which is, it's like, you know a lot about a little,
mm-hmm.
instead of a little bit a lot. I'm always I just want to know little anecdotes about everything, and then I lose focus when I go try to get it more in depth.
And Derek, were you a history buff?
I wasn't. I mean, I enjoyed history. An amazing history teacher, Mr. Stang, that, you know, he was really good at humanizing historical figures. And I always feel like that's our goal, and that it's a lot easier to learn when you don't know you're learning.
What's your favorite era?
Grunge, I guess.
The grunge era. The history of the 90s.
No, I don't have a favorite. I really don't. I think if I had a favorite anything, it's just the type of story that I like, a story that has someone going up against all odds because they have something inside of them that they need more people to know about, that what's inside of them is more important than life or death, that they have to get this accomplished.
I also love it when our stories, like the Octavia Spencer one and the Roald Dahl one, which is, you think you know this story, you think you know about Harriet Tubman, now we're going to show you this side of her where she was a Union spy going down and showing people where mines were, and she was like an action star. And just nobody talks about that part of her life.
So are you scrupulous about your accuracy, or do you not care?
We really care. We really care about it, because if it wasn't real, then what would be the point of the show? I really think that without the heart, how the show has become a show and not just a 5-minute idea is only because of these stories. They have to be stories that you love. And my hope is, like, I picture, like, a bunch of college kids, like, laughing and drinking, and then the nerd in the back Googles it, and he's like, wait, guys, that's all true. And they're like, what? Yeah, but if they don't, that's okay, too.
And we have researchers, we have PhD professors who are researching for us, we have fact checkers. We definitely, it's not just left up to Derek and I to know whether or not.
And your drunk narrator.
Yeah. I'm going to give away a secret here because it's KCRW. Yeah, press play. But really, it's not that we're trying to make a comedy show. We're trying to make a history show. Mm-hmm. So the comedy is them trying to tell this history, and we're trying to tell it the best we can. And it's not trying to be funny. You know, I humbly say it just is funny because of the trouble of trying, the condition that they're in, trying to articulate their passion.
Because you couldn't do this if they weren't drunk.
It would be boring. History is pretty cool, but it's not what is said. It's how it's said, I believe. It also pulls, it's hard to talk about this without sounding egotistical, but I think it also pulls you in as, like, when you're watching a show, you like to feel like you're at the party, not watching a party. So having them drunk, you know that they don't know what they're going to say next, and you know what I mean? Like, you feel like anything can happen because of that state, instead of like, why am I watching this when I can just read it, read about this story?
Just go on Wikipedia and
right, yeah,
be done with it, right?
But this is also like, the show could never have been just pitched. We had to incubate it on the internet for years, you know, like, there's no way we could have gone in and just said, we're going to get people drunk and tell history and reenact it. I mean, even when we pitch it to, you know, my uncle, I'm like, he's like, what? So, yeah, I think it was a very unique time that we got to develop this concept and make it something.
Derek Waters, Jeremy Connor, creators of Drunk History, the third season premieres tonight on Comedy Central.
10:30.
Woo! So yeah, Derek sounded drunk, Barbara, but that's just how he talks, he told me.
I'm a huge fan, as you know. My favorite part in every show, someone has to lie down on the floor at some point while they're talking.
Well, it's just too much. It's just too much to handle. What's on To the Point?
Well, I hope it's not too much. We're talking about China, and it kind of is too much. The underlying economic problems that are driving this market instability and volatility, and we're also talking about the politics contributing to it. And one of our guests calls Beijing's insistence on an 8% annual growth an enormous runaway Ponzi scheme.
Yipes.
Very troubling and driving, feeding the lack of confidence in the government.
Okay. And lack of confidence in stocks here, maybe. Volatility, at least.
Ripple effects.
Yes, ripple effects. Okay, thank you, Barbara Bogay, sitting in for Warren Olney. I'm not drunk. Sitting in for Warren Olney To the Point at 1 o'clock. And coming up on this show, Caltrans now selling more than 400 homes it seized decades ago in Pasadena, South Pass, El Cereno. It's the final chapter, maybe, in a decades-long battle over the 710 extension. That's next on Press Play.
Browse the KCRW store and shop for vacations, wine classes, frequent flyer miles, dinners, and merchandise. Shop to support KCRW only at kcrw.com/store.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Well, if you're looking for a house in the Pasadena area, you can call a realtor or you could call Caltrans. Beginning in the 1950s, the state's transportation agency started buying homes in Pasadena, South Pass, and El Cereno to make way for a 6-mile extension to the 710 freeway. But there has been fierce opposition. And after decades of legal and political wrangling, it looks like the extension will happen underground, if it happens at all. So now Caltrans is getting ready to sell all of those houses, some 400 of them, and the people who rent them are worried that they will be priced out. Laura Nelson talked to some of the tenants. She writes about transportation at the LA Times. Welcome.
Hi, thank you.
So tell us about these houses. What are they? What do they look like?
Well, it depends on which neighborhood you're in. In El Sereno, which is kind of where the 710 freeway ends on Valley Boulevard, the homes are pretty small. They're like one or two bedroom cottages, very modest. Most of them less than 1,000 to 1,500 square feet. But up in the Pasadena area and the South Pass area, the homes look, you know, they're big and beautiful. Some of them are really, really lovely craftsmen, 4 to 5,000 square feet, lots of bedrooms, big lots, and like really kind of majestic old homes.
And they bought these homes, Caltrans bought these homes beginning in the 1950s, but kept on buying up property?
They did, yeah. Some of the homes were bought as recently as 1998.
Oh, wow. And did they pay market rates, market prices?
They did, yeah. Eminent domain, which is, you know, the law that allows state agencies to seize property for projects, it requires them to pay like an assessed rate. So mm-hmm. the homeowners, in theory, were given what they thought was a good deal. But that was a long time ago.
Right. And now real estate is just going bonkers, especially in the tonier parts of the cities. And so how much would they get for these homes now?
Well, they haven't all been assessed yet, but if you look at the homes that are nearby, you can get a good sense of, you know, how much more it might be. In my story, I wrote about one home that was bought in the early 1970s for about $21,000, and it's less than 1,000 square feet. It's in South Pass, but it's very small. It's on a road that overlooks the 110, and other homes on that street are now selling for more than $800,000.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, so it's like a huge increase.
So that nice home you mentioned would be going for a lot more than that.
I would think so. Millions, probably.
Millions. Okay. So it sounds like a good deal for Caltrans, but maybe not such a good deal for the people living in these houses.
Yeah, it depends on, you know, obviously how much the tenants make and how long they've been there and all those things. But Caltrans has put in place a process that would allow at least some tenants to possibly get a below market rate deal, depending on how much money they make and whether or not they were the original owners of the house. So if your house was bought by Caltrans and you still live there, you might get a cut rate price to buy it back from them. Maybe.
Maybe. So who are the people living in them? Are some of them original owners renting?
That I know that some of them are, but I don't know how many. It depends on what neighborhood they're in and, you know, what the houses are like. It ranges from, I spoke to a couple people who've been in these houses for more than 20 years. They raised their families there. It really feels like home. And they're hoping that they can, you know, they've been wanting to buy for a very long time, and they're hoping that they can just get a good price and that they'll be able to. Other families, you know, make a lot of money, maybe two working professional parents, and they make enough money that they wouldn't qualify for a below market rate deal. So there's also some questions about whether or not just kind of generally well-off middle-class folks will be able to afford prices that could be over $1 million.
Well, would Caltrans be under any obligation, given the fact that it's not supposed to be making a profit, to sell these at a reasonable price to the people who've been living in them for a while?
They are, depending on, it all depends on income level. So if you make below a certain amount of money, Caltrans is required by law to offer you a below market rate deal that could be adjusted based on how much money you make. If you're above 150% of the median income for the county, you would just be, you would go to auction with everybody else and get your shot.
Hmm. And so meanwhile, how has Caltrans been as a landlord?
There have been some concerns over the years. I'm sure you've heard about it. You know, it's kind of cropped up in the news every like 5 to 7 years, someone who has an issue with how their house has been maintained. Most tenants say that, you know, the emergency issues, like you have a sink backed up or whatever, those things tend to get taken care of right away. But the smaller repairs, like garage doors not working or light fixtures that don't work or maybe an emergency railing that you'd like to have installed on your porch, that kind of stuff can take years to fix sometimes. And the homes that are vacant, if a family moved out and no one else came in, or if they've just been sitting empty for a long time, neighbors and residents have been upset that those homes have kind of fallen into disrepair.
So give us a quick overview of what is happening with the 710 extension. Is it dead, finally, the above ground extension?
It is. Yeah, it is. At least the freeway option. So the MTA, which is conducting the environmental studies for the project, 3 years ago, their board of directors formally eliminated the above-ground freeway option, which means that they're still studying a bunch of other options, but no matter what they pick, the above-ground freeway is not going to be, you know, the one that ends up happening. So they're still thinking about a light rail line, a bus line, or a big freeway tunnel that would be underground. So that means that Caltrans just doesn't need most of these properties anymore because the freeway won't be running through there.
Okay. And so it goes. Laura Nelson writes about transportation at the LA Times. Thanks.
Thanks.
Myers is here now with the listener feedback.
Truth. But first, yeah? I have some ideas for drunk history.
Uh-oh. Are you drunk?
Maybe. Drunk on all of my ideas. The history of nachos, I think, would be of interest.
Because you could eat them as you were telling the history?
That's absolutely right. Uh-huh. I think they should do an episode on Soul Train, how that began. That would be a good one,
that's
right?
So good. They could just listen to our piece on Soul Train.
That's right. And then we could watch Derek Waters dancing down the Soul Train line, which would be really, really satisfying. I also put it to our listeners what they wanted to see come next on Drunk History. And we got a couple good ideas. Betsy Holmes says that the heroes of the space race should be on the next season of Drunk History, or the history of 70s funk music legends. That would go hand in hand with the Soul Train episode that they're now going to do, because it's
course
a really
they're
great
do
idea.
It. Yeah.
And Hillary LaRoe says she wants to see some international drunk history. She wants to see world history. She suggests the Great Emu War would be fun to see. I have no idea what that is, but I'm assuming by its name, it would be very fun to see.
Emus, as in the big
bird. We have some Googling
bird
to do after this.
Oh my gosh. I hope it's emus versus ostriches. That's what I hope.
Let's just assume that that's it.
Okay. Jolie Myers, thank you very much. If you want to weigh in on anything at all, from emus to what have you, Twitter is at KCRW Press Play, Facebook KCRW Press Play. Barbara Bogave sitting in for Warren Olney coming up at the top of the hour, so keep it right here on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.